Pensacola's first choice for morning news, traffic, sports, and talk. The Pensacola Morning News with Andrew McKay. News Radio 92.3 AM 1620. Good morning, Pensacola.
Bring y'all's attention to House Bill 53 and Senate Bill 1076. These bills have, as a House and Senate companion bills, they've made it through their committees and subcommittees, and looks like they're both going to the floor with a very good possibility of getting turned into law. These bills will have the effect of denying state funding to any municipality or county that has a local preference.
So if you're wondering what Commissioner Doug Underhill's talking about here, there's these companion bills, 53 and 1076, and we'll talk with Alex Andrade this morning about this at 6:35 and find out whether this understanding of them is correct. I have read them, and I don't have any reason to doubt what Doug is saying. I think he's right. The premise of the bills is to, or at least the portion of them, is to prohibit local preferencing in procurement. You know, the kind of thing that says the covenant with the community kind of stuff that says you're going to shop local if you're a government. And so if any municipality does that, then they lose state funding. Now, you might have a project that doesn't have any state funding attached to it. But, you know, some of the projects that we do involve state funding, like so many of them, right? I've always raised this question about the covenant with the community kind of stuff, the local preference kind of stuff, is I get the argument in favor of it, certainly, that A, you want to preference local because it's local, that's sort of an intuitive thing. B, the economic benefits of hiring a local firm as opposed to and out of the area means that the money is going to get spent back here, so you have that recirculation benefit. And from a municipal standpoint, you possibly have the tax benefit as well, right? If you are able to tax them on the things that they're spending here, or if it's actually got a physical space and you've got real estate tax, you know, there's certain recoupment involved in spending the money. Whereas if you spend the money out of town, maybe you don't get that much or at all. And then the third one is accountability. And in the era of Skanska and the Pensacola beach sign, as Sam Abel, city manager from Gulf Breeze, reminded us last week, you know, Gulf Breeze is a city sandwiched between two obvious lessons in why hiring local and accountability are important. Well, this is kind of the premise, is at least if you hire local, you know the people, or you have the ability to apply leverage to them if something goes wrong, just because, again, they are local. But at the same time, you're spending more money. I mean, you can argue all you want that hiring local makes sense, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying, but at least admit it costs more. Because if it doesn't cost more, then you're just hiring the cheapest, right? And if you're hiring the cheapest and it happens to be local, great. And if you hire the cheapest and it happens to be out of town, well, if you then choose to hire local, you're paying more. And so I think the concept at the state level is, why would we match you in spending money where you're paying more? And why do we have low bid procurement concepts? To prevent favoritism. Good old boy network stuff, right? The whole idea is you want to put everybody in an even playing field. Well, nothing's more even than dollars. And so why would the state want to be matching projects or offering project money to be used in situations where people are given a deal to their buddy or their political donor or their whatever, right? Maybe it's not even anything nefarious. Maybe it's just local and maybe their cost is higher, or maybe the quality isn't as good. The point is, when you're talking about competitive bidding, you're trying to get the lowest price and the best quality, some kind of a blend of those things. throwing diversity or localism into the match makes things more complicated. And these bills, if they go through, that's basically what they're trying to eliminate so that you can get, theoretically, the biggest result for the state funds that are spent on local things.
I've been talking for quite a while about how local preference ordinances are rife for causing costs to go up. They're ripe for causing favoritism in the procurement process, and they're really not appropriate. And it's true that at this point, Tallahassee appears to see that has become a problem statewide.
So again, this is Commissioner Underhill just kind of alerting the commission about this, and I had not been tracking these bills. I track as many as I can, but I don't track them all.
If this becomes law, which it has a very good chance that it will, then counties like Escambia that have a local preference ordinance in our procurement will be cut out of state funding. So, again, that's House Bill 53, Senate Bill 1076. Just wanted to bring that to your attention in case you hadn't seen that happening in Tallahassee. Thank you.
Now, not everybody sees it that way. This will come as no surprise to those of you who follow the drama and the personalities of the Escambia County Commission or the Santa Rosa County or the City Council. But, you know, it used to be that it was Josh that got along least well with Doug Underhill. Recently, it's been Stephen Berry. Stephen Berry is, they're just never on the same page, or so it seems. In fact, actually, Doug and Jeff are on the same page more frequently than Doug and Stephen are. But okay, he's a commissioner for District 5. That's the North End.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Commissioner Berry.
Even if that were to happen, that language already exists in federal funding. So I think we can navigate it.
Right on. Thank you, Commissioner Berry, for that clarification.
That assumes that the limits, and what he's saying is that in federal funding, there's the same kind of concept already. That assumes that we are able to navigate it. This is not obvious to me. And in fact, I'll put forward a concept for you to consider. You know how there's been a lot of hubbub lately over Escambia County not doing the covenant with the community and not doing the local hiring or the local, contract awards and things like that? Let me give you a theory. Okay, theory number one, this is the theory that I think a lot of your social justice activists have in mind, is that somehow the leadership of the county, they're just trying to do nefarious things. Okay, you know, if you're going to start there, fine. It's hard for me to persuade you. Okay? Nefarious comes in a variety of flavors, but this is the allegation. Concept number two is there's a good reason why. I suppose you might say incompetence. Okay, we're just incompetent, can't do it. Again, if you're going to presume incompetence or nefarious motives, well, it's hard for me to talk to you a lot. But here's another possibility is maybe there's a reason. And maybe the reason is, for example, maybe the reason we don't do local preferencing with things that involve federal money is because we can't. And it's actually illegal to do it. Well, if that's true, and so then the story is not, oh, how dare they? The story is, well, they're following the law, and the covenant of the community has problems. Now, all of a sudden, if the state of Florida puts that same language into effect, you follow. So I am no lawyer. I'm certainly no procurement expert. I don't pretend to be able to say definitively whether Doug or Stephen is right on the interpretation, but the premise that we can just work around it and do what we want to do regardless of what the federal law or the maybe soon to be state law says, not sure that premise is accurate. 517 on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. It's Pensacola Morning News. Davis, we do our bike ride every week, and we've recently been going to Tiger Point, is where we're working our way around everything east of the Live Oaks, because we've done Gulf Breeze proper in the past. We were in Polynesian Island or Isles? Which one is it?
Polynesian Islands.
Islands, okay. Which is on the north side, just west of the Gulf, the Garçon Point Bridge Landing, Redfish Point, and west of there. Holy smokes, man. It's my job to know the area. And one of the things that I have been blown away by in going biking the area around, like I said, Tiger Point, east of the Naval Live Oaks, all that area, north and south of 98, is all of the canal neighborhoods. I just, I mean, I guess you can know a thing and not really know how prevalent it is. There's so many. And they're so interesting because, like, Villa Venice, if you drive through there, it's obvious it's canals because the roads go right across the canals and you can see it. Whereas a lot of these other areas, like over on Tiger Point on the south side of the golf course there, or Polynesian Island, and several others, you kind of have to be paying attention to notice because they're all behind the houses, behind the fences. They don't really show themselves publicly to you unless you're looking for them, or you happen to notice, oh, it looks like a sailboat mast behind that house. That's weird. You know, which is kind of how you might notice. Or it seems like in all of these streets, there's no trees in between the backyards. It's just kind of odd. Anyway, but I think it's great. I love it. I think they're amazing. And I think of the foresight that went into developing that. I think it's fascinating. 437-1620, 437-1620. Mark Jacobs is in the newsroom this morning with our headlines. Mark?
The European Union ready to welcome American tourists back as long as they're fully vaccinated. New York Times reporting borders may reopen by this summer after being closed more than a year.
Ready to go.
Protesters taking to the streets in North Carolina Sunday, demanding more answers around the police shooting death of Andrew Brown Jr. last week. He was reportedly shot as he tried to drive away from officers attempting to serve a search warrant. Nomadland, the big winner at this year's Academy Awards, as expected. The movie took Best Picture last night, along with Best Director and Best Actress. The oldest actor to ever win an Oscar is happy and grateful, although he skipped last night's show. Anthony Hopkins was back home in Wales, asleep. His agent telling people he woke up the 83-year-old to tell him he'd won.
His agent telling them they woke up the aged.
Had to wake up the agent who woke up the actor.
And that was a surprise because Chadwick Boseman was the one that everybody assumed was going to win.
Right.
Plus, having passed away, you know, there's a certain thing. How many of the Oscar nominees did you see? Have you seen so far? Because you're a movie guy. I mean, you're not an enormous movie guy, but you're a movie guy. You like me.
I haven't been to a movie in a theater in over a year.
But not at home, not on DVD, not a zero. Zero?
Nope, not. Haven't seen any of them.
I have seen one. The Trial of the Chicago 7. It was very good. I mean, it's very good.
And the film that Anthony Hopkins is nominated for is one that I would like to see.
The Father? The Father. Me too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to see several of them, but, you know... Where? Well, if you have Hulu, great. If you don't, can't see Nomadland. No. You know, it's coming out on DVD, you know, tomorrow. But then you got to... So, I don't know. We're in a weird, fractured place with all of the different streaming services and the difficulty. I mean, once upon a time, at least there was the expectation that if you wanted to see these movies, just go to the theater and see the movies.
Right. Which is how I prefer to do it.
Right. And now, well, go to the theater and also have Netflix and also have Hulu and also have Disney Plus and also have HBO Max and also have Amazon Prime. And, you know, maybe then you'll have seen most of them if you try.
Just can't bring myself to sign up for 18 different.
I am completely there
services.
With you. I am. And weirdly, I mean, maybe if you could just buy the one thing at home, maybe people would do. I don't know. I'm with you. It's kind of like the, you know, just in the old days, you'd have ABC, CBS, NBC, and then eventually you had Fox. But you had three or four networks that showed the TV.
Right. And that's all we've had for a while. We cut the cable. Just been using an antenna.
Yeah.
The last year.
You did cut the cable. I mean, you cut all the cables.
Cut all of it. And although I have to admit, I finally had to sign back up for cable yesterday.
Oh, that must have been painful.
It was.
You get used to not having a mortgage.
My dad put it in good perspective because I was telling him how I think total we pay $25, $30 for streaming services a month. Mm-hmm. And my dad said, well, it's cheaper than my $250 per month for DirecTV.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, that's true, too, is if you went that route, I think probably it's just what you're familiar with.
Right.
You know, all of us who are older than you, Davis, we grew up with the idea of having a TV delivery platform. Over the air at a time, but even we got used to it was cable and then maybe it was satellite, but it was satellite or cable. It was never neither, and we got used to having one thing. And now you can buy four different streaming services and have as much variety by far, way more than we had when we were growing up on anything.
And you should have seen how life-changing it was when my dad discovered Netflix last year. He always knew about it, but he didn't want to dedicate the time to it. Well, immediately he found his favorite shows.
Yeah, but Netflix is also, can I be the one to say it? They do have very good stuff. But a lot of the Netflix stuff is really B grade. And once you get past the like premium excellent stuff, it's then rewatching things you've seen before or, you know, talking yourself into believing it's quite as good. That's my own impression. I'm not against it. I mean, I like that, you know, we have it, okay? I'm just, it's not, if that were all you had, I think it's pretty not enough. 525 on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. That submarine has been declared a loss after they found some pieces of it, three different pieces of it, deep in the water. Recovery is going to be hard. 53 crew on board found they had some deep pressure or, you know, deep dive kind of equipment that they were, they also found, like, you know, suits, okay, that were designed to resist the high pressure of, you know, low depth. And it looks like they might have been trying to put those suits on and when everything went wrong. So it's a tragedy, certainly a tragedy for the Indonesian Navy and for the global Navy that identifies with them in solidarity. Meanwhile, the B-1 bomber fleet has been grounded indefinitely over a fuel problem, the fuel system problem. This is kind of interesting because, you know, all of these legacy aircraft are on their way out. And different people have tried at different points and with different level of success to try to eliminate them. You know, the A-10 is the one that's just sort of always. Actually, you know, I don't know where that is currently in terms of our use and or maintenance of it. Because that was one that everybody tries to get rid of. And every time they try to get rid of it, it's like, this is super cheap and it works really well. Why are you trying to get rid of something so effective? But the B-1 Bomber Force is now third time in 3 years over a fuel system issue. The indefinite safety stand down to conduct maintenance inspections on the fuel filter housing. Ellsworth Base B-1 began leaking fuel onto the ground. That's not ideal. That's not a good thing. While taxiing to the parking area after landing, so at least it was at landing, as a safety measure, precautionary measure, the commander directed a one-time inspection of all of them. The inspection went on. After further analysis, they decided to go ahead and put the whole fleet on standby, on stand down for the moment. And they say, and this is what was weird to me, is zero operational impact, providing bomber task force support to combatant commands around the globe. That means we don't need them. I always understood, and if you're in the Air Force or you understand the deterrent threat properly, I always understood the B-1s to be one of the key elements of the deterrent threat. But maybe I'm mistaken about that. At least these days, they say no impact. Well, I guess no impact on bomber task force support. That's different than other missions that it might have. But in any case, they're working to retire them all. The active fleet, they're working down to 45 of the best functioning ones. Remember, these are old. This been around the B-1 since the late 70s, I think, something like that. They're planning to retire them all within the next 15 years. And finally, the F-15 EX. Remember, we got all excited about the first EX coming to Eglin. They got another one now. So they've got their two that they're going to go put through their paces and test, and that's that. Let's call it the alternate route from the F-35, the F-15 EX, the reworked F-15, the workhorse. Mark Jett, nice. It's striking, but, you know, it's a workhorse in the Air Force.
I'm Jim Chesko with Your Money Now. Having determined that the benefits clearly outweigh the risks, a federal advisory committee has recommended that use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine resume in the U.S. That could happen as soon as this weekend if finalized, but J&J and regulators indicated they would add language to the product label warning of the potential for a rare blood clot condition. The week ahead will be the busiest one of the spring in terms of major corporate earnings reports. On the schedule are some 40% of S&P 500 companies, including tech heavyweights Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google parent Alphabet, Facebook, and Tesla. Also due to report quarterly results, Boeing, General Electric, Comcast, Merck, and Colgate-Palmolive. When it's all said and done, first quarter profits are expected to be up a sharp 34% from a year ago. Technology shares had a strong day today, leading the market to solid gains. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite leaped 198 points, or 1.4%. The Dow Industrials rebounded 227 points. That's Your Money Now.
is the scariest of times and the most exciting of times. I see the civil discourse as having many benefits. It's getting people engaged who otherwise haven't been. We had one of the highest turnouts in voting the last election. Yet at the same time, we see some of the cracks in our system. We have a great deal of partisan, very heated debate going on. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can turn into an awful thing, into something that destroys the fabric of our community. If we don't learn how to talk to each other, how to discuss things with each other, and how to change things in a positive rather than in a negative way. And that's what civic participation is about. That's what civic education is about.
So there are not going to be a lot of opportunities for me to agree wholeheartedly with Sonia Sotomayor, Supreme Court Justice of the United States. But she and Justice Neil Gorsuch, who admittedly agree very often about nothing, or it's not really true, but when there is an opportunity for disagreement, she and he are going to be opposite sides, okay? And yet, they gave this joint presentation recently about the importance of civic engagement. And what she just said, I couldn't agree with more. That's 100% accurate. And I don't think this is a uniquely awful time in American history. I think that civic engagement and the ability to conduct intelligent, meaningful, tolerant, but not tolerant in the I'm going to put up with you sense, tolerant in the I'm going to listen to you sense and allow you to disagree with me, and that's okay. That's not a threat to my identity. It's always been that way. One of the most interesting things that I ever did that I always remember is I think it was at a garage sale. I found a book that was political cartoons of like the 1830s or something like this. And I remember looking at them thinking, you know, those are pretty vicious, pretty awful. I knew some of the facts of the cases. I didn't know a lot of the facts of the other cases. And so, you know, part of the problem with political cartoons is you really have to know what's the story behind the cartoon. But even without knowing the story, it was obvious that these were just wickedly mean cartoons. And I thought, you know what? It's always been this way. And again, as I knew some of the characters involved and I knew some of the stories, and I thought, well, those aren't even accurate. It's always been this way. You know, Andy Marlett draws for the PNJ. Sometimes they're fair. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're on target. Sometimes they're not. And he's certainly not the worst of all the ones. He is often the best of all the ones. It's always been this way. America's always been a place where we fight a lot. You know, where the Thanksgiving dinner, you know, where the families argued about stuff, that's America. Now, that doesn't mean that it's always healthy or that every version of it is healthy. But the notion that there was ever going to be or that there ever will be a placid, calm, cool, peaceful moment where we all agree about everything, that's a fantasy. Don't ever have that as your dream. And they don't, by the way. Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch don't have that as their dream. The challenge is, what she's getting at, and what he's getting at, is in the presence of the disagreement, right? In the rancorous, divided, bitter political environment, we have to figure out how to talk to each other. Not just accuse each other of being stupid or evil or both, but really engage with each other. And the way I like to think about this, I'm going to play some more of the clips here in a second because it's so good. But the way I think about this is you got to be able to be friends with people you don't agree with. That's a skill. That's a skill. That's learning to cherish what's interesting about people. That's learning to see behind the political ideas and see people as who they are and the choices that they make, and not just as an amalgam of beliefs that you may agree or disagree with, but as individuals who are generally kind of wonderful, you know, and smart, even if they're wrong. I mean, it's a dumb thing to have to say. but I think most of my really close friends are liberals. And it's not most. I don't know. It's a lot. Okay? We disagree about politics and religion and society. Well, how can you be a friend of those people? Because they're people. And they're wonderful. And they're charming and engaging. And it doesn't... If the basis of being in a relationship with somebody else is that you agree with them, you're such a narcissist. The only thing you can endure is somebody else who looks like you. That's just racism when it's applied to beliefs. And see, anyways, there's a lot in this, but you have to start seeing people that way. And then talking with them. And that can be the challenging part.
Sony and I care deeply about this issue, and we talk, both of us, a lot about it. And we do, I think, because we share a common conviction. And I don't want to speak for you, Sonia, but I think on this one, we probably agree that you have to ask yourself, how can it...
We don't agree that often on things, so this
not
is...
Not on other things, but this one we agree. How can a democracy function if we can't talk to one another? And if we can't disagree kindly, with respect for one another's differences and different points of view.
Now, you hear them talking, and if you use social media at all, it can be very... what's the word I want? You want to judge them for being old and naive. They're old, but they're not naive. They know that social media tends to fragment people. I don't know whether they're users of any of the platforms or not. But I understand that social media brings out a lot of bad things in us, but we allow it to bring the bad stuff out in us. I mean, I don't know about you. Maybe I'm weird on this. There's a lot of stuff I don't say on social media. And when I disagree with people, I try to do it charitably. I try to do it kindly. I try to be winsome. It's a word people don't use much anymore. But, you know, I want them to want to see my side, as opposed to wanting them to want to hate me or get angry at me. I mean, it's Dale Carnegie stuff, right? Make people want to agree with you. Make people wish they could, whether in person or on the radio or at a city council meeting or over dinner or lunch somewhere or on social media. Now, that's not the main focus of what they were getting at, but that is one of the key things that they were talking about in this presentation. They were also talking a lot about civic ignorance, which is, oh my gosh. But again, let me caution you that it's tempting to picture some imaginary point in the past where everybody got along. It is also tempting to picture some imaginary point in the past where everybody knew all the things they're supposed to know. People have always been ignorant. People have always not understood their government. It may be at a bit of a peak right now, but for most of my adult and even childhood life, people have been complaining about this. Now, does that mean that it's not worse than it ever has been? No, I think it probably is worse, but it's not a new thing, right?
You know, if you look back through history, how did democracies die? They don't tend to last long in history. And they don't tend to fall apart because they've been subject to invasion. They fall apart from within. They crumble. And there becomes a hunger for a certain faction to take over because they're intolerant of others. They think they know the right answer and that others do not. And that it is time for us to impose our will on others rather than to work together and resolve our differences through lawful processes.
That is the underlying theme behind the First Amendment, right? Free speech is not just meant to be a protection so that you can spout off. Who cares about that? The idea of free speech is that you're supposed to want to engage people who disagree with you so that you're excited about it, willing to do it, and willing to have them engage you. Not just so you can have your say and walk off, drop the mic and go away and feel misguided and proud of what you didn't accomplish. The purpose is so that we talk, so that we engage. Not just so that people have to leave you alone when you want to have your say. The idea is that we should want to hear what people have to say and think about it and consider it and try to see it from their point of view. even if we're going to reject it. That's what civic engagement means. That's what a democracy presupposes. Because if all we are is warring factions, then don't get me wrong, again, we will always be warring factions. We're supposed to be warring factions that put country first and each other in a position of some kind of mutual respect. So the toleration or tolerance that says, leave me alone, I'm going to leave you alone, that's not American. The toleration or the tolerance that says, you know what, I'm going to allow you to hold your views even if we disagree, but I want to talk about it first. That's the idea. And again, I know a lot of their speech that they were doing was about civic ignorance and the importance of understanding how civics works and what a Supreme Court is and what are the branches of government and what's the Constitution. Yes, absolutely. Of course, you have to have that too. But there has to also be this kind of cultural premise that we don't talk at each other, we talk with each other. And that's how we resolve things. Because the alternative is civil war. And that's what a democracy ultimately is meant to be a substitute for, a civil war. 549 on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay.
If I had my time again,
here on News Radio 92.3 AM 1620. I'm Andrew McKay. It's the Pensacola Morning News. Mark Jacobs is in the newsroom with our headlines. Mark?
U.S. troops in Afghanistan starting to move out, marking the beginning of the end of America's longest war. Top American commander there confirming early withdrawal is underway. Comes after President Biden said it would happen by September 11th. Little more than half of Americans approve of the president's performance. NBC's Kelly O'Donnell reporting on his first 100 days.
It has been dominated by handling of the COVID crisis and vaccine rollout. He will also use this well-known juncture to make his very first address to a joint session of Congress. That comes in prime time Wednesday night.
A new NBC News poll finds 53% think Biden's doing a good job. A Fox poll has it at 54%. New study challenging the rules of social distancing. A couple of MIT professors say it doesn't matter if you're 6 feet or 60 feet apart indoors. They claim the risk of spreading coronavirus is basically the same, even if you're wearing a mask.
Because?
Because they say so.
So it's interesting because, Mark, thanks for the update. It's interesting because the older guidance from the CDC was things like, you know, wear a mask, yes, social distance, yes. But it was also time of exposure, you know, and the time of exposure matters. I think that's all true. And I know a lot of times what we do is the people who wear masks or are pro-mask, which is me, have this idea like it's magic. And we tend to think this way anyway. You know, we tend to think being outside is magic or sunlight is magic or hand sanitizer is magic because you just don't really think much about the underlying physics or the biology of what's involved. But take masks, for instance. If you're in a room with somebody else for a prolonged period of time, unless you are wearing an extraordinarily good, you know, N95 sealing mask, and you cover your eyes too, probably important. I mean, the likelihood of them having aerosolized whatever is in their body into the air that you're now surrounded by is fairly good. So it's not that what's the point, it's that the longer you're in a room with closed air, you know, enclosed air around other people, the less it matters. You know, when I see people that are in big groups in these crowded environments wearing a mask, I think, I'm not sure that you understand what's going on here. It's always meant to be in all of the above. It's not meant to be that if you wear a mask, you can do anything. Just like in the social distancing, you know, if you're 7 feet apart or 10 feet apart, but you're in a room, well, if you're, you know, coughing, let's say, you're putting droplets out and the big droplets fall to the ground. Right? That's the basic theory of the respiratory droplet transmission mechanism. But there's also smaller particles, the ones that we call aerosols, that hang up in the air and can contain things. And those can travel quite some ways because they're hanging up in the air. And I think the most sobering, just basic experiment of this is, have you ever been outside on a cold day and breathed? Where does your breath go? a long way. And you can only see it for a little ways, but you can see how quickly it moves. You can see how far it goes very quickly. And it becomes obvious that breath is going to go a lot farther than just 6 feet. So, do I think there's no difference between them? No, I think that study is that conclusion is not right. But do I think that each of these rules individually is some magic formula? Like, hey, he's at 7 feet, we all good. No, this is not. It's reducing the risk. And again, I'll say what I said from the very beginning. I don't know if you've been listening to my show for a long time, but way back at the very beginning, before the CDC recommended face coverings, when I was wearing one because it was like really early in this process and I had been sick and my wife was like, you know, maybe these face masks make sense because the Asians do it to cover themselves. You know, when they're sick, that's historically the idea behind a mask. It's not to protect me from you, but to protect you from me. To me, the face mask has always been and still really is like just coughing into your shoulder or coughing into your arm. It's a better version of that. That's the primary benefit. And if everybody's just kind of breathing into something that's a barrier, there's less of the stuff from inside of us all over the air that we're sharing. I mean, that's the basic idea. Yes, there's benefit to preventing it from coming into you, but the less the seal is secure, the more you're around the air, all of that kind of stuff, you know, the less that really matters. 5:56 on News Radio 92.3 AM 1620. Every once in a while, you got to remember the basics. Those are some of the kind of the basics of what we're doing. I'm Andrew McKay. Too well, Davis. You give me that Cyndi Lauper. I'll take it. All right. So we were talking a minute ago about civic engagement, the role of being basically not just tolerant, but engaged with other people and talking to them. There's also a kind of, I don't know, you should try to be fair. Because if you have to be unfair in engaging other people, it means you're admitting from the outset that they're probably right and you're probably wrong. So I really despise unfairness, especially in the media, and I see it all the time. And I'm sure people would complain about me in this regard, too, and I'm not saying I'm perfect at it, but it just bothers me when you see things that are unfair. George Stephanopoulos interviewing Senator Rick Scott yesterday on This Week. Just, I want you to listen to this question.
Florida Senator Rick Scott, he's chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Senator Scott, thanks for joining us this morning. Let's start out with the Chauvin verdict. Was justice served in that case? Your governor, Ron DeSantis, suggested the jury might have been scared of what a mom may do. Do you agree with that?
That's not asked genuinely. That's asked as a pretext to throw a jab at DeSantis over misinterpreting something that he said that Rick Scott is not going to be able to spend a lot of time reacting to. That's dishonest. And in fact, if you go back and listen to what DeSantis actually said about the George Floyd case.
When I saw the video of that cop murdering George Floyd, I was just absolutely appalled by what I saw.
And rightly so. But did he also raise the question of how could those jurors not know that they were in an environment surrounded by threats? That's a fair question to ask, too.